Fine video. Good morning and good to be with you again. If you're visiting, glad that you're here. We tend to see a lot of new people in summer because I guess summer is the time that people move and like you get settled in the new place you are before you settle into your rhythms with like the start of school in September. And so that makes sense. And if you are new here, very glad to have you visiting. If you're visiting today, good day to visit because we're starting this new series. What we do as a church Bible teaching or a preaching schedule is we pick books of the Bible and then we just go kind of right through it. We read chapter by chapter, verse by verse, line by line. We don't tend to skip anything because we want to hear everything that God has to say to us. And so we just finished in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. I say that, but that's not exactly how we're going to do this new series. So just like violating the rule that I told you. But it's because it's Proverbs. And like if I tried to preach chapter by chapter through Proverbs, either it'd be like one verse a week or we'd all be getting whiplash because one verse in Proverbs is going to say, you know, here's when the wise man knows to, you know, be silent and not open his mouth. And the next is like a door on its hinge is a lazy man turning on his bed in the morning. And you're just like, they're not really related. It's like punchy wisdom. But there are themes. There are themes throughout Proverbs, and so what we're going to do is take 10 weeks and focus ourselves on what God says about something that this world honestly desperately needs, which is wisdom. Other things are important too, but other things get the limelight. They get like so much more of the focus. So like knowledge and facts and like scientific approach, like that gets a lot of the limelight and focus, and that's an important thing. And like teaching on morality and understanding what's good and what's evil, that was an outrageous sneeze. God bless you. Like, you're ready to be a dad. That's a dad sneeze right there. You know, in the church, we teach about morality and understanding good and evil and what God says about what's good and evil, as we should, and that's important too. But just listen, like, say that every day you make 100 decisions a day, more or less, right? Could be far more, could be less, who knows? Most of those decisions do not depend on like your scientific knowledge, and most of those decisions don't depend on your understanding of what's good and what's evil. Things like, how should I write this email? Should I buy this thing or not? Where should I go for lunch? Should I be silent right now or should I be speaking? Should I call my mom right now? Should I just listen to music? Those decisions are not decided by the rules that govern morality. They're not decided by the rules that govern science. And yet, it's the bulk of the decisions that we make every single day and over the course of our lives. And so if you're getting all the moral decisions right, which, let's be honest, like you're in church and we believe that all people are sinners. So you're not. No one is, but even if you're getting lots of the moral decisions right, you could still make an absolute mess of your life if you have no access to wisdom. Like if you don't find wisdom, if you're not growing in wisdom, that's why God gives us Proverbs, and that's what we're looking at for the next at least 10 weeks, maybe an extra. And so buckle up, you know. We're looking today at an introduction to wisdom itself. We're going to be in Proverbs chapter 8, not the full thing, but that's where the bulk of this teaching is going to come from, Proverbs 8. The first 9 chapters of Proverbs is kind of like an introduction to wisdom, and then it's from chapter 10 on that you get into like the punchy, like every verse is something. In chapter 8, we're going to find 4 important truths about wisdom. We're going to see the importance of wisdom, the definition of wisdom, the problem with wisdom, and the solution for wisdom. So if you're a note taker, you like outlines, those 4 things, importance, definition, problem, and solution for wisdom. So here we go. Chapter 8, starting in verse 10, says this, "Take my instruction instead of silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold, for wisdom is better than jewels, and all that you may desire cannot be compared with her," or cannot compare with her. It's helpful in reading Proverbs to remember the person who's writing it is Solomon. Solomon's the king of Israel. He's the son of David. He's the king that comes after David. And actually, just real quick, we're going to jump to 1 Kings chapter 3 because we see this really important, poignant encounter that Solomon has with God, where God says to Solomon, ask me, what shall I give to you? He's like giving an open door. Ask me for something, I'll give it to you. And we read this. Solomon says, give your servant, therefore, there's a lot that comes before this, but give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people? It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. And God said to him, because you have asked this and have not asked for yourself long life or riches or the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. Solomon asks for wisdom, and God is so pleased with this request, like he wants his people to be wise. In particular, he wants the leaders of his people to be wise. And so God gives him wisdom, and with that, he gives him riches and honor. And we know from the way that it's all described, Solomon is unparalleled in his wealth and his fame and his honor and his glory as a king when he's reigning. He has everything, and his days are peaceful. And so when that person says, wisdom is more important than choice gold, nothing that you could desire compares with wisdom. You could put those verses back up. He's speaking from experience. He's speaking as someone who has all the wealth and who has the wisdom, and he knows which is better. He knows what we think, what every person thinks, that, you know, the thing that's keeping me from having my ideal life is blank. If only I had more money, if only I had the right job, if only I could find the right person or find the right house or do this or that or accomplish this in my career, if only I could get these things in order, then I'll be content and my life will be everything that I want it to be. Solomon says, you're missing out on a really important part of it if that's what you think. Something fundamentally more important and more deeply valuable. Nothing compares in value to wisdom. Because just think about it. Like, how many times have you heard the story of someone who made it, who has all the things that you think, if only I had those things, then I'd be all right. They have those things. And yet, because of their foolish decisions or their foolish ways, their life unraveled and fell apart. We hear that story all the time. It's not enough to get yourself to a successful place in life if you don't have the wisdom to handle that success. And at the same time, how many people do you know who are not sitting on a mountain of wealth and don't have like the most stellar career? Like, they're pretty average, and yet they're doing really well in life. They're maintaining healthy relationships. They're not self-destructing their health or their finances. Like, they're doing well. Paul says this in Philippians 4. He says, I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. So there's a wisdom here that Paul is aware of, so that no matter what circumstance he's in, he's able to be content. He's able to make wise decisions and live his life the way that he should. He's not going to miss out on opportunities or miss out on appreciating things because he's so busy being bitter about what he doesn't have and he wishes that he had. And he's not going to become so arrogant and full of himself that he becomes wasteful or self-destructive just because he happens to be doing really well. He's learned the secret, and we'll come back to that later. The point is, whatever your fill-in-the-blank is, and just think about for a moment, what is my fill-in-the-blank? What is the thing that I erroneously believe, if only I had this, I could be content? if I was more talented, if I was smarter, if I was more accomplished, if I was better looking, if I was wealthier, healthier, whatever it is, there is something you should want more than that. Because if you don't have wisdom, you could have all those things, and in the end, your soul could still be ruined. And in the long run, it's of no benefit to you at all. It's wisdom. We need wisdom. And wisdom is more than just making the morally correct decisions. That's part of wisdom, because like it's foolish to do evil things or wicked things or the wrong things. It's foolish from a pragmatic standpoint because of what you stand to lose if you get found out, like the consequences that go hand in hand with doing evil. It's wise to just avoid those. That's why we have like business ethics classes. Like people recognize, you know, it's smart, it's wise to do the right thing, keep it all above board. But wisdom is not less than making the morally correct decision. It's so much more though, because you can sadly do a lot of damage with really good intentions. Like coming from a morally good place, but you lack wisdom. For example, spoiling your kids. Spoiling your kids, that usually comes from a place of love. Not always. Sometimes it's selfishness because I don't want to deal with the hard parts of being a parent. I don't want to deal with the tantrum. I just want to do the easy thing, the quick fix, give them what they want, and ignore them. So sometimes it's that. I think most of the time it's because I love my kids. I don't want them to feel distress. I want them to have all the things that would make them happy. And so you do. You meet all of their needs, and you bend over backwards for them, and you make them the center of your world, and you care for them so much. And then the damage is done. Because you've failed to make them wise. You failed to prepare them for the real world. You've given them this false expectation that they're going to be the center wherever they go, and the world's going to bend over backwards for them, and that if they're not getting the things that they want, they have the right to treat people as terribly as they want until they get it. You've turned them into selfish little monsters, and it's going to take a tremendous amount of work and a really painful process of being humbled to even start to undo all the damage that you've done to them because you love them, and you didn't want them to suffer, but you were foolish, and so now they are. So you can come from a good place and do that. It's the same thing, like if there's a poor person or a poor family and you want to help them, and you do it from a good moral standpoint, and you do it ethically, it's not illegal, but because you don't understand the complexities of how poverty works and you just dump a pile of money or whatever it is that you do, you don't understand how that could be throwing their life into chaos and causing them so much more grief and ultimately end up in a worse place. Because you're not wise. You don't understand. You don't understand. There's a whole book written on this. There's a few books, but the one I like, When Helping Hurts, talks about people who do damage by their good intentions because they don't understand the things that they should before they involve themselves. We need wisdom when we make decisions about helping people. We need wisdom when we raise our kids. We need wisdom to strengthen our marriages. We need wisdom to decide where we're going to live and what we're going to do and where we're going to go to school and what we're going to buy, how we're going to manage our time, when we're going to talk, when we're going to be silent. All those things. And the rules that govern morality don't cover the answers to those questions, for the most part. And the rules that govern, you know, like scientific knowledge, they don't govern the answers to those questions. And a wrong decision in one of these things that aren't covered by the rules of morality, they're not covered by the rules of science, a wrong decision there, or a string of wrong decisions, could be a disaster for your life. The reason some of you may have that kind of sinking feeling in your life where you just don't know what to do, and you're so worried about it, this problem that's in front of you or this opportunity that you don't want to mess up, you don't want to get it wrong, is because you don't have the wisdom to address it. See the importance of wisdom. More to be desired than gold. If you have money but you don't have wisdom, if you have power but you don't have wisdom, if you have beauty but you don't have wisdom, it's a disaster waiting to happen. So what is wisdom exactly? What is it? How can we define it? Let's see this in verse 12. Proverbs 8, verse 12 says, I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and I find knowledge and discretion. The fear of the Lord is hatred of evil, pride and arrogance and the way of evil, and perverted speech I hate. I have counsel and sound wisdom. I have insight. I have strength. By me kings reign, and rulers decree what is just. By me princes rule, and nobles, all who govern justly. So we get all the pieces that we really need to understand wisdom here. And because Proverbs loves to use words that can be synonyms for wisdom or supplements to wisdom to give us the full picture of what wisdom is. And so we read, you know, wisdom dwells with prudence. Wisdom finds knowledge and discretion. These words are all translated from Hebrew. And our English translations are trustworthy, but sometimes there's words in the Hebrew that carry a certain nuance to it, or they get used in particular contexts that is more difficult for us to pick up on when we just read from the English. And so the Hebrew word for knowledge or for insight is often used to describe knowing how things really work. Not just knowing the way that things should work. Like in an ideal world, this is the way that things should be. But in the real world, with all the complexities of the real world, how is it that things really work? You have insight into that thing. You have knowledge into that thing. Like how people really work and relationships really work. Taking into account things like jealousy, rivalry, love, humility, arrogance, hurt. Like all those things and how those might affect a person or a relationship. And the word for prudence, Hebrew word for prudence, is often used in a context to describe noticing little distinctions. So you see things the way that they really are. For example, like politicians have a lot to say about the way things are. They always talk about the way things are. But wisdom understands that politician has a slant and a bias and a vested interest in getting you to see things the way that they see things, right? They have something to gain. And so the way that things really are might be somewhat different or might include some things that were left out or some things are embellished. Like it might be a little bit different than the way that the politician is describing it, which I know, shocking that they would do that. Did you guys see that debate? Hope not. The fear of the Lord is hatred of evil. Here, fear is used in the sense of reverence and awe and respect for God, which in Proverbs 9, we read that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And this is the moral aspect of wisdom, that wisdom cares about what God tells us is good and evil. Right, wisdom makes God our moral authority. We don't get to make up the rules about what's good and evil. We get to understand what God tells us about what's good and evil. And then, by me, by wisdom, Proverbs says, kings reign and rulers decree and princes rule. It's through wisdom that people know how to make the correct decisions. Right? Using your knowledge about the way things really are and the way things really work, being able to then make the correct decision with regard to God as our moral authority. That's what wisdom is. One author of a commentary on Proverbs defined wisdom like this, that wisdom is becoming competent with regard to the realities of life, which I love. The way that life really is, because some people have a lot of trouble dealing with life the way that it is, and what they do is they kind of view life in a way that suits them and is convenient for them, but there are certain things that they ignore. There are certain things that they're getting wrong, they're refusing to see, and it can make a mess. In 2 Samuel 15, this is when David is king, and this is during an episode in David's life where his son, Absalom, is staging a coup against him. And so David is chased out of Jerusalem. Absalom's trying to overthrow him, and people are switching to Absalom's camp. One guy who switches to Absalom's camp is a man named Ahithophel. He is a man renowned for his wisdom, and David knows, like, if Absalom's getting counsel from this guy, I've got no chance. Like, this is it for me. And so what David does is there's a man with David who's fleeing named Hushai, and David tells him, go back to Absalom, tell him, forget David, I'm with you now, I want to be one of your guys. And his mission is to persuade Absalom to not listen to Ahithophel. Whatever Ahithophel says, say the opposite and convince him. Make sure you do that. And so so he goes, and Absalom's at a point where he needs to make a decision. Do I pursue David now, or do I wait and gather my strength? And Ahithophel says, you need to go right now. David's on the run. He's thrown off his rhythm. Like, this is your chance. If you go now, you can defeat David, and when David's defeated, no one will have the right to challenge your rule to the throne, and you'll be king, and you'll be established. And he goes, sounds good to me. Does anyone think differently? And that's when Hushai speaks. And the way that he convinces Absalom to not do that is he plays to Absalom's fear and also to his vanity. And so speaking to his fear, he goes, listen, we're up against David. Do you remember David? David and Goliath? Yeah, David won, right? Saul, king of Israel, tried his hardest to destroy David, and he couldn't do it. He lived in the wilderness. He knows the wilderness. You want to pursue him? He has his mighty men with him. He's the warrior king. He's a man who lives and breathes war. There's risk. And then speaking to his vanity, he says, but Absalom, people love you. You are so beloved. All of Israel loves you. If you wait, more and more people will gather to you. David's men in the wilderness will see he's not the answer. They'll switch to you. All you have to do is wait. Don't take the risk. Bide your time. Build your strength. And then you'll be able to go and defeat David decisively. And Absalom likes what he hears. And so he listens. When Ahithophel sees that Absalom listens to Hushai, he goes home and he gets his affairs in order and he hangs himself. Because he knows there's a man who's not going to listen to wisdom. This is a man who's unable to understand the way things really are and the way that things really work. And so he's incapable of making a good decision. And if you don't understand wisdom, it might not happen immediately, but at some point, it'll catch up to you. He knows David's going to overcome this, and he's, why wait around? David knows I threw in my lot with Absalom. Absalom fails to see the situation as it really is. He fails to see himself. So he has too low a view of his own strength and too high a view of his own glory. That's his foolishness. So he thinks David's strength is so much greater than mine. He's afraid. He doesn't understand that he has the advantage. And he thinks that the love that people have for him is so great that David's closest men would abandon him and join him. All right, he's not seeing things clearly. And this brings us to the problem of wisdom, because it is a problem. Why are we not wise in the way that we should be? Like, why are we so capable of being so wrong in seeing things the way that they really are and seeing ourselves the way that we really are? We have such a mistaken view, like a bad take on things, or our failure. Why are we so capable of failing to see the way that things really work? We think it's going to work out for us. We think it's going to work if we just go ahead forward with what we decide, and that's not the case. Let's look at verse 22. Proverbs 8:22. This is wisdom speaking. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. Ages ago, I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before he had made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world, when he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit, so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a master workman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and delighting in the children of man. Here, wisdom is personified, right? It's being treated as a person who is active with God in creating everything that he makes. And this is like kind of unique. So if you study ancient cultures and their creation myths, their creation accounts and how they believed the world came to be and everything in it and all of life, what you see are two broad categories where this isn't actually true reality. We're living in an illusion. Or creation is the result of like war of the gods, like a conflict with the gods. And so like this god was killed by this other god, and his body fell, and that became the land. That became that mountain over there, like that kind of thing. And the reason for that, possibly, is to explain like all the problems in the world. Because the ancient peoples, they were experiencing war and disease and famine and flood and disaster of all kinds. And so like, why is this world so full of conflict? Like maybe it's not even true reality. Maybe we're living in this illusion or dream. And the secular view, the modern secular view, is that all this is kind of an accident. Like it's not created with purpose. It doesn't exist for reason. It just happened that everything was created, and it just happens that it could support life, and it just so happens that life became self-conscious, and here we are. But what we read here is that God creates the world and everything in it with wisdom, with a purpose, and in a way that makes sense. And he's created it to be this place of overwhelming joy and beauty and peace, for him to delight in it. Obviously, something happened there. We'll talk about that in a second. But the elders and the teachers of Israel, they would, when they would teach about wisdom, they would say the reason that wisdom works, the reason that we have wisdom, is because there's a pattern to the fabric of this world. There's a pattern that God created things to function in a certain way. Wisdom is recognizing that pattern. And that's what Proverbs teaches us to do. You think of something like physics, like aerodynamics, and just the pattern that that the world functions according to it. So in another life, I was in the New Jersey Army National Guard, and I was an unmanned aircraft system operator. So I was flying drones. And I even became an instructor in that. And so as part of my training and my education, I learned about aerodynamics, and I learned how an airplane stays up. It's because of the shape of the wing, and because air moves more quickly over the top of the wing than the bottom, it creates an area of low pressure on the top and high pressure on the bottom, and that generates a force called lift. And that's why an airplane flies. And you also need thrust to move forward. But if you obey those rules, the rules of physics and aerodynamics, then an object is going to fly. If an object fails to obey those rules of aerodynamics, it's going to crash. It's going to burn. Like Boeing planes, apparently. Don't get on the 737 MAX. I heard they changed the shape of the wing to save money or something. There's a pattern to the reality of flight that you need to recognize and adhere to the rules of that pattern in order to fly. There's a pattern to the reality of relationships. And if you don't live in accordance with the pattern that governs how relationships work, that relationship is going to disintegrate. It's going to crash and burn. There's a pattern to spiritual reality. If you don't live in accordance with the pattern to that spiritual reality, your spiritual life is going to crash and burn. And that's what sin is. Sin is rejecting God himself, who is our creator, who made these patterns, who loves us and gives himself for us, and by our sinful foolishness and refusing to submit ourselves to the rules of those patterns, our spiritual lives have crashed and broken, and this world itself has become broken and filled with conflict and suffering of all kinds. Foolishness is going against the pattern that God has put into his creation when he made it, and it always leads to breakdown. There are two things that you have to know about the pattern of reality in order to be wise. You need both of these things. One, you need to acknowledge that there is a pattern. You need to acknowledge that there are a set of principles that when you abide by that set of principles, things tend to go well, and if you reject those set of principles, things tend to fall apart. But two, you need to acknowledge that you can't fully know or predict the pattern. Like, not with 100% certainty. And what I mean is, Proverbs is written a certain way for a reason. It's not just all a hodgepodge. So the first 9 chapters are introduction, and the chapters 10 through 15 are actually telling you, here's the general principles for life that are normally true, right? They're not promises, but they're principles. It's the way that things generally work. If you're lazy, you're going to waste away, and if you're hardworking, you're going to prosper. Like, that's something that you'll read in those first 5 chapters, 10 through 15. If you care about living righteously, you'll live long, you'll do well, and if you're wicked, you're going to suffer. If you raise a child in the way he should go, even when he's old, he will not depart from it. Right? Those are the things that sound really good, especially if you have like more of a conservative bend to you. Like, if that's the person that you are, you hear these things and you go, yeah, that's right. Work hard, live righteously, do the right things, and things will work out for you. Like, what's so hard to understand? But then we get to chapter 16, and from chapter 16 on, this is where Proverbs starts showing us exceptions to the principles and how things normally work, because it's going to say, sometimes you live righteously, and your life is really hard. It's filled with hardship and suffering. And sometimes the wicked prosper. Sometimes they have an easy time. Sometimes you work hard, and you're still going to be poor, because you're oppressed and you're taken advantage of, and there's nothing you can do about that. And even if you do all the right things in raising your kids, they could still grow up to become foolish. This is the stuff that people with a more liberal bend in them, they hear that and they go, yeah, you hear that? Uh-huh. It's not just do the right thing. Sometimes you do all the right things and it's just stacked against you, and there's nothing you can do about it. So what's wisdom? We need both of those things, all right? Like, if you don't acknowledge there is a pattern and there are principles that are generally true and it's how life normally works, if you just reject that, you're a fool. You're a fool. If you think the problem is always that people aren't doing the right thing, people didn't do the right thing, I'm just going to do all the right things and it's always going to go well for me. Like, that's just not how it works. But if you choose to make the exceptions the rule and say, well, there's no point to doing those things, you're a fool. You could be a more liberal fool or a more conservative fool, whichever one you want. Or better yet, you could humble yourself and you could listen and you could think deeply and consider broadly and become a wiser person. But we're still all going to be fools sometimes. So what's a good solution for this? It feels like a pretty tall order, a pretty impossible task. Like, how do you make yourself into this wise person where you can fairly accurately see, this is the way that things really are, this is the way that things really work, so I know the right thing to do, and I'm going to consistently recognize and pursue the pattern that God has created the world with. This is how it normally goes, but I'm also going to be able to recognize whenever there's exceptions to that pattern. It's not easy. Proverbs is meant to help us. It's meant to equip us. Proverbs was used for a long time by the people of Israel as like this training manual for training in righteousness, and it'd be done in their community. The parents would be training their children in wisdom using Proverbs, and then as they grew older, they'd have mentors who would train them in wisdom through using Proverbs, because you need the whole thing. You can't pick and choose in Proverbs. No single proverb gives you the whole picture of any subject. You need to hear lots of different perspectives and angles and truths about a subject that Proverbs is going to give you, and you're meant to look at all of that and reflect on all of that and discuss it and hear real-life examples about these different things, right, with someone that you trust, someone who's older and walked further than you, your parents, and then a mentor, and that's how you slowly learn and grow to be a wise person. That's not something that really happens a whole lot, you know? Like, we have schools that train us in knowledge, and the church, we spend a lot of time training people in understanding good and evil and understanding, going the way that God tells us to go. I think passively we can pick up on wisdom in the church, but it's not as much an active pursuit as it could be in these other areas, like if it's happening in the home with the parents, if it's happening in a mentoring relationship. But even if this is something that your parents wanted to do with you, and your parents were great, I do think it's difficult to spend a lot of consistent, dedicated time actively training in wisdom, and not everyone's going to have that. Like, if you're grown and you didn't have that, then, like, you missed it. You just didn't have it. Lots of people have never really had a mentor in their lives. So, like, what do we do if we missed out? Well, the solution we see in here, and kind of the most basic point about wisdom in Proverbs 8, is that Proverbs is personified and turned into a person. And what if, when Solomon wrote Proverbs and he used the wisdom that God had given him to write Proverbs, and he's speaking inspired from the Holy Spirit as he writes Proverbs, what if God meant for us to understand something from this fact that wisdom is turned into a person? What if that's something that at some point was not a metaphor, but a fact? It's something that really happened. Wisdom became a person, and a relationship with this person could make you wise. This person would be the ultimate guide to you, the ultimate mentor, the ultimate counselor to you. Some might say a wonderful counselor. In Matthew 12, Jesus is speaking to people about his ministry, people who see his ministry and who fail to see God's power at work through his ministry. They're just blind to it. They're blinded by their jealousy. They refuse to see it. And Jesus says this: "The queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here." Solomon's wisdom is so renowned in the world that the Queen of Sheba goes and visits Solomon in order to hear his wisdom. And Jesus says, something greater than that wisdom is here, something greater than the wisdom of Proverbs, the wisdom that's personified, something greater than that is here, and it's Jesus himself. John makes it so clear for us in the Gospel of John, chapter 1, just like we read the creation account in Proverbs 8, where wisdom is personified and active in it. John chapter 1, we hear this: "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men." Calling Jesus the Word, and the Greek word here, New Testament Greek, the Greek word is logos, where we get the word logic from. And John is speaking to a concept that the Greeks are familiar with about the concept of logic and wisdom, as well as the Hebrew understanding of the word of God, God's self-proclamation and revelation of who he is. God himself, the word of God, the wisdom of God, was in the beginning with God and was God himself, and all things were made through him. In verse 14, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have all seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. He became a person. It's the incarnation. He took on human nature, human flesh, a person that you can know and have a relationship with, because by his wisdom, he would take all of our sin and all of our foolishness that's made a mess of this world and made a mess of our lives and our hearts and our souls, and he does the one thing that can untangle it and straighten us out and make us new. By going to the cross to stand in our place and pay the debt that we owe so that we could be forgiven and we could be set free. Jesus alone has the ability to do this. Jesus alone possesses enough riches of grace that he could do this, the riches of his righteousness, that he could extend that righteousness to us as a gift and cover our sins. That's the wisdom of God. This is something that is baked into the fabric of reality in all of creation. The reality of his love for you. That he would go so far for you. So that if you would have wisdom, if you would recognize this is the way that things are. This is the way that God is. This is the way that I am. If you would acknowledge that this Jesus, who is God and our creator and who we've sinned against, recognize that he became a person, he preached repentance and the forgiveness of sins in him because of what he accomplished for us. I make a decision to respond to that. I'm going to put all my trust in him, all my faith in him. I'm going to surrender to him. I'm going to live my life for him. I want to know him and walk with him and honor him with my life and listen to what he tells me about who I am. You start this relationship with this person, wisdom personified, the wisdom that tells you about God's love for you, and that makes you new. And you hear what he says, and he makes you wise about yourself. You start out on the right foot because you start hearing what he says, and you know, I'm not as great as I can be prone to think I am. I can be prone to think that I'm pretty good on my own. I'm a pretty good person. I'm doing all right. I don't need anything. I don't need anyone's help. And he says, no, you're a sinner. You need salvation. You can't do this on your own. Right? He humbles you. But I'm also not as worthless as I could be prone to think I am. I'm a mess. I'm a wreck. I'm nothing. I bring nothing good to this world. I have no value, right? People get there, and Jesus says, listen, you are worth so much to me that I gave my blood for you on the cross. That's how much you matter. That's how much I value you. You listen to what Jesus says, and you understand with wisdom, the way that you really are, the way that a relationship with God really works. And you can begin to walk in true wisdom. Remember what Paul wrote in Philippians 4. He says, I know how to be brought low and I know how to abound in any and every circumstance. I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. It's all through Jesus. It's all through Jesus that I am equipped and able to become wise to handle any circumstance that I might encounter in life. Because I know when things are great, I'm not going to put my security in that. I'm not going to put my identity in that. I'm going to keep it in Jesus. And I know when things are not going well, this doesn't mean I'm not loved. This doesn't mean that I'm abandoned. He went to the cross for me. He's prepared an eternity for me. He sets you up to walk in wisdom so that you don't unravel, you don't fall apart, but you become stronger, you become resilient, and you could be at peace. I hope that we would all grow in the wisdom that Jesus gives us. Let me pray for us. Dear God, thank you for providing.